This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Ubik by Philip K. Dick, performed by Luke Daniels. 1. Friends, this is cleanup time, and we're discounting all our silent electric Ubiks by this much money. Yes, we're throwing away the Blue Book, and remember, every Ubik on our lot has been used only as directed. At 3:30 a.m. on the night of June 5th, 1992, the top telepath in the Sol system fell off the map in the offices of Runciter Associates in New York City. That started vidphones ringing. The Runciter organization had lost track of too many of Hollis's size during the last 2 months. This added disappearance wouldn't do.
Mr. Runciter, sorry to bother you.
The technician in charge of the night shift at the map room coughed nervously as the massive, sloppy head of Glenn Runciter swam up to fill the vid screen.
We got this news from one of our inertials. Let me look.
He fiddled with a disarranged stack of tapes from the recorder which monitored incoming messages.
Our Miss Dorn reported it. As you may recall, she had followed him to Green River, Utah, where,
sleepily, Runciter grated,
"Oh, I can't keep in my mind at all times which inertials are following what keep of precog."
With his hand, he smoothed down his ruffled gray mass of wire-like hair.
"Skip the rest, and tell me which of Hollis's people is missing now."
"S. Dole Melipone?"
the technician said.
"What? Melipone's gone? You kid me."
"I not kid you,"
the technician assured him.
"Edie Dorn and two other inertials followed him to a motel named the Bonds of Erotic Polymorphic Experience, a 60-unit subsurface structure catering to businessmen and their hookers who don't want to be entertained. Edie and her colleagues didn't think he was active, but just to be on the safe side, we had one of our own telepaths, Mr. G.G. Ashwood, go in and read him. Ashwood found a scramble pattern surrounding Melipone's mind, so he couldn't do anything. He therefore went back to Topeka, Kansas, where he's currently scouting a new possibility."
Runciter, more awake now, had lit a cigarette. Chin in hand, he sat propped up somberly, smoke drifting across the scanner of his end of the bi-channel circuit.
"You're sure the teep was Melipone? Nobody seems to know what he looks like. He must use a different physiognomic template every month. What about his field?"
"We asked Joe Chip to go in there and run tests on the magnitude and minitude of the field being generated there at the Bonds of Erotic Polymorphic Experience Motel. Chip says it registered at its height 68.2 BLR units of telepathic aura, which only Melipone, among all the known telepaths, can produce."
The technician finished.
"So that's where we stuck Melipone's ident flag on the map, and now it is gone."
"Did you look on the floor? Behind the map?"
"It's gone electronically. The man it represents is no longer on Earth, or as far as we can make out, on a colony world either."
Runciter said,
"I'll consult my dead wife."
"It's the middle of the night. The moratoriums are closed now."
"Not in Switzerland,"
Runciter said, with a grimacing smile as if some repellent midnight fluid had crept up into his aged throat.
"Good eve."
Runciter hung up. As owner of the Beloved Brethren Moratorium, Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsung, of course, perpetually came to work before his employees. At this moment, with the chilly, echoing building just beginning to stir, a worried-looking clerical individual with nearly opaque glasses and wearing a tabby fur blazer and pointed yellow shoes waited at the reception counter, a claim check stub in his hand. Obviously, he had shown up to holiday greet a relative. Resurrection Day, the holiday on which the half-lifers were publicly honored, lay just around the corner. The rush would soon be beginning.
"Yes, sir,"
Herbert said to him with an affable smile.
I'll take your stub personally.
It's an elderly lady,
the customer said.
About 80, very small and wizened. My grandmother.
Will only be a moment.
Herbert made his way back to the cold pack bins to search out number 305-4039-B. When he located the correct party, he scrutinized the lading report attached. It gave only 15 days of half-life remaining. Not very much, he reflected. Automatically, he pressed a portable photophazon amplifier into the transparent plastic hull of the casket, tuned it, listened at the proper frequency for indication of cephalic activity. Faintly from the speaker, a voice said,
And then Tilly sprained her ankle and we never thought it'd heal. She was so foolish about it, wanting to start walking immediately.
Satisfied, he unplugged the amplifier and located a union man to perform the actual task of carting 305-4039-B to the consultation lounge, where the customer would be put in touch with the old lady.
You checked her out, did you?
The customer asked as he paid the pause creds due.
Personally, Herbert answered. Functioning perfectly.
He kicked a series of switches, then stepped back.
Happy Resurrection Day, sir.
Thank you.
The customer seated himself facing the casket, which steamed in its envelope of cold pack. He pressed an earphone against the side of his head and spoke firmly into the microphone.
Flora, dear, can you hear me? I think I can hear you already. Flora?
When I pass,
Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsung said to himself,
I think I'll will my heirs to revive me one day a century. That way I can observe the fate of all mankind.
But that meant a rather high maintenance cost to the heirs, and he knew what that meant. Sooner or later they would rebel, have his body taken out of cold pack and, God forbid, buried.
Burial is barbaric,
Herbert muttered aloud.
Remnant of the primitive origins of our culture.
Yes, sir,
his secretary agreed at her typewriter. In the consultation lounge, several customers now communed with their half-lifer relations in rapt quiet, distributed at intervals, each with his separate casket. It was a tranquil sight, these faithfuls, coming as they did so regularly to pay homage. They brought messages, news of what took place in the outside world. They cheered the gloomy half-lifers in these intervals of cerebral activity. And they paid Herbert Schoenheit von Vogelsung. It was a profitable business, operating a moratorium.
My dad seems a little frail,
a young man said, catching Herbert's attention.
I wonder if you could take a moment of your time to check him over. I'd really appreciate it.
Certainly,
Herbert said, accompanying the customer across the lounge to his deceased relative. The lading for this one showed only a few days remaining. That explained the vitiated quality of cerebration. But still, he turned up the gain of the proto-phazon amplifier, and the voice from the half-lifer became a trifle stronger in the earphone.
He's almost at an end, Herbert thought.
It seemed obvious to him that the son did not want to see the lading, did not actually care to know that contact with his dad was diminishing, finally. So Herbert said nothing. He merely walked off, leaving the son to commune. Why tell him that this was probably the last time he would come here? He would find out soon enough, in any case. A truck had now appeared at the loading platform at the rear of the moratorium. Two men hopped down from it, wearing familiar pale blue uniforms. Atlas Interplan Van and Storage, Herbert perceived, delivering another half-lifer who had just now passed, or here to pick up one which had expired. Leisurely, he started in that direction, to supervise. At that moment, however, his secretary called to him.
Herr Schoenheit von Vogelsung, sorry to break into your meditation, but the customer wishes to assist in revving up his relative.
Her voice took on special coloration as she said,
The customer is Mr. Glenn Runciter, all the way here from the North American Confederation.
A tall, elderly man with large hands and a quick, sprightly stride came toward him. He wore a vari-colored Dacron wash-and-wear suit, knit cummerbund, and dip-dyed cheesecloth cravat, His head, massive like a tomcat's, thrust forward as he peered through slightly protruding, round and warm and highly alert eyes. Runciter kept on his face a professional expression of greeting, a fast attentiveness which fixed on Herbert, then almost at once strayed past him, as if Runciter had already fastened onto future matters.
"How is Ella?"
Runciter boomed, sounding as if he possessed a voice electronically augmented.
"Ready to be cranked up for a talk? She's only 20. She ought to be in better shape than you or me."
He chuckled, but it had an abstract quality. He always smiled and he always chuckled. His voice always boomed. But inside, he did not notice anyone, did not care. It was his body which smiled, nodded, and shook hands. Nothing touched his mind, which remained remote. Aloof but amiable, he propelled Herbert along with him, sweeping his way in great strides back into the chilled bins where the half-lifers, including his wife, lay.
"You have not been here for some time, Mr. Runciter,"
Herbert pointed out. He could not recall the data on Mrs. Runciter's lading sheet, how much half-life she retained. Runciter, his wide, flat hand pressing against Herbert's back to urge him along, said,
"This is a moment of importance, von Vogelsang. We, my associates and myself, are in a line of business that surpasses all rational understanding. I'm not at liberty to make disclosures at this time, but we consider matters at present to be ominous, but not, however, hopeless. Despair is not indicated, not by any means. Where's Ella?"
He halted, glanced rapidly about.
"I'll bring her from the bin to the consultation lounge for you,"
Herbert said. "Customers should not be here in the bins."
"Do you have your numbered claim check, Mr. Runciter?"
"God, no," Runciter said. "I lost it months ago. But you know who my wife is. You can find her. Ella Runciter, about 20, brown hair and eyes."
He looked around him impatiently.
"Where'd you put the lounge? It used to be located where I could find it."
"Show Mr. Runciter to the consultation lounge,"
Herbert said to one of his employees who had come meandering by, curious to see what the world-renowned owner of an anti-Psy organization looked like. Peering into the lounge, Runciter said with aversion,
"It's full. I can't talk to Ella in there."
He strode after Herbert, who had made for the moratorium's files.
"Mr. von Vogelsang,"
he said, overtaking him and once more dropping his big paw onto the man's shoulder. Herbert felt the weight of the hand, its persuading vigor.
"Isn't there a more private sanctum sanctorum for confidential communications? What I have to discuss with Ella, my wife, is not a matter which we at Runciter Associates are ready at this time to reveal to the world."
Caught up in the urgency of Runciter's voice and presence, Herbert found himself readily mumbling,
"I can make Mrs. Runciter available to you in one of our offices, sir."
He wondered what had happened, what pressure had forced Runciter out of his bailiwick to make this belated pilgrimage to the Beloved Brethren Moratorium to crank up, as Runciter crudely phrased it, his half-lifer wife. A business crisis of some sort, he theorized. Ads over TV and in the homeopapes by the various anti-Psy prudence establishments had shrilly squawked their harangues of late. "Defend your privacy," the ads yammered on the hour from all media. "Is a stranger tuning in on you? Are you really alone?" That for the telepaths, and then the queasy worry about precogs. Are your actions being predicted by someone you never met? Someone you would not want to meet or invite into your home? Terminate anxiety. Contacting your nearest prudence organization will first tell you if in fact you are the victim of unauthorized intrusions, and then, on your instructions, nullify these intrusions, at moderate cost to you.
Prudence organizations.
He liked the term. It had dignity, and it was accurate. He knew this from personal experience. 2 years ago, a telepath had infiltrated his moratorium staff, for reasons which he had never discovered. To monitor confidences between half-lifers and their visitors, probably. Perhaps those of one specific half-lifer. Anyhow, a scout from one of the anti-Psi organizations had picked up the telepathic field, and he had been notified. Upon his signing of a work contract, an anti-telepath had been dispatched, had installed himself on the moratorium premises. The telepath had not been located, but it had been nullified, exactly as the TV ads promised. And so, eventually, the defeated telepath had gone away. The moratorium was now Psi-free, and to be sure it stayed so, the Anti-Psi Prudence Organization surveyed his establishment routinely once a month.
"Thanks very much, Mr. Vogelsung,"
Runciter said, following Herbert through an outer office in which clerks worked, to an empty inner room that smelled of drab and unnecessary micro-documents. "Of course," Herbert thought musingly to himself,
"I took their word for it that a telepath got in here. They showed me a graph they had obtained, citing it as proof. Maybe they faked it, made up the graph in their own labs, and I took their word for it that the telepath left. He came, he left, and I paid 2,000 pulse-creds."
Could the Prudence Organizations be, in fact, rackets? Claiming a need for their services when, sometimes, no need actually exists? Pondering this, he set off in the direction of the files once more. This time, Runciter did not follow him. Instead, he thrashed about noisily, making his big frame comfortable in terms of a meager chair. Runciter sighed, and it seemed to Herbert suddenly that the massively built old man was tired, despite his customary show of energy.
"I guess when you get up into that bracket," Herbert decided, "you have to act in a certain way. You have to appear more than a human with merely ordinary failings."
Probably Runciter's body contained a dozen artiforgs, artificial organs grafted into place in his physiological apparatus as the genuine, original ones failed.
"Medical science," he conjectured, "supplies the material groundwork, and out of the authority of his mind, Runciter supplies the remainder. I wonder how old he is," he wondered.
Impossible anymore to tell by looks, especially after 90.
"Miss Beeson," he instructed his secretary, "have Mrs. Ella Runciter located and bring me the ident number. She's to be taken to office 2A.
He seated himself across from her, busied himself with a pinch or two of Fribourg and Trier Prince's snuff, as Miss Beeson began the relatively simple job of tracking down Glenn Runciter's wife. 2. The best way to ask for beer is to sing out Ubik, made from select hops, choice water, slow-aged for perfect flavor. Ubik is the nation's number one choice in beer, made only in Cleveland. Upright in her transparent casket, encased in an effluvium of icy mist, Ella Runciter lay with her eyes shut, her hands lifted permanently toward her impassive face. It had been 3 years since he had seen Ella. And of course, she had not changed. She never would now, at least not in the outward physical way. But with each resuscitation into active half-life, into a return of cerebral activity, however short, Ella died somewhat. The remaining time left to her pulse phased out and ebbed. Knowledge of this underwrote his failure to rev her up more often. He rationalized this way, that it doomed her, that to activate her constituted a sin against her. As to her own stated wishes, before her death and in early half-life encounters, this had become handily nebulous in his mind. Anyway, he would know better, being 4 times as old as she. What had she wished? To continue to function with him as co-owner of Runciter Associates. Something vague on that order. Well, he had granted this wish. Now, for example, and 6 or 7 times in the past. He did consult her at each crisis of the organization. He was doing so at this moment.
"Damn this earphone arrangement," he grumbled as he fitted the plastic disc against the side of his head. "And this microphone."
all impediments to natural communication. He felt impatient and uncomfortable as he shifted about on the inadequate chair which Vogelsung, or whatever his name was, had provided him. He watched her rev back into sentience and wished she would hurry. And then, in panic, he thought,
maybe she isn't going to make it. Maybe she's worn out and they didn't tell me, or they don't know. Maybe, he thought, I ought to get that Vogelsung creature in here to explain. Maybe something terrible is wrong.
Ella, pretty and light-skinned, her eyes, in the days when they had been open, had been bright and luminous blue. That would not again occur. He could talk to her and hear her answer. He could communicate with her. But he would never again see her with eyes opened. Nor would her mouth move. She would not smile at his arrival. When he departed, she would not cry.
Is this worth it?
He asked himself.
Is this better than the old way? The direct road from full life to the grave? I still do have her with me, in a sense,
he decided.
The alternative is nothing.
In the earphone, words, slow and uncertain, formed. Circular thoughts of no importance, fragments of the mysterious dream which she now dwelt in.
How did it feel,
he wondered,
to be in half-life?
He could never fathom it from what Ella had told him. The basis of it, the experience of it, couldn't really be transmitted.
Gravity,
she had told him once.
It begins not to affect you, and you float more and more. When half-life is over,
she had said,
I think you float out of the system, out into the stars.
But she did not know either. She only wondered and conjectured. She did not, however, seem afraid or unhappy. He felt glad of that.
Hi, Ella,
he said clumsily into the microphone.
Oh.
Her answer came in his ear. She seemed startled, and yet, of course, her face remained stable. Nothing showed. He looked away.
Hello, Glenn,
she said with a sort of childish wonder, surprised, taken aback to find him here.
What?
She hesitated.
How much time has passed?
Couple of years, he said.
Tell me what's going on.
Oh, Christ,
he said.
Everything's going to pieces. The whole organization. That's why I'm here. You wanted to be brought into major policy planning decisions, and God knows we need that now. A new policy, or anyhow, a revamping of our scout structure.
I was dreaming,
Ella said.
I saw a smoky red light, a horrible light, and yet I kept moving toward it. I couldn't stop.
Yeah,
Runciter said, nodding.
The Bardo Tho Scroll, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, tells about that. You remember reading that? The doctors made you read it when you were...
He hesitated.
Dying, he said then.
The smoky red light is bad, isn't it?
Ella said.
Yeah. You want to avoid it.
He cleared his throat.
Listen, Ella, we've got problems. You feel up to hearing about it? I mean, I don't want to overtax you or anything. Just say if you're too tired, or if there's something else you want to hear about or discuss.
It's so weird. I think I've been dreaming all this time, since you last talked to me. Is it really 2 years? Do you know, Glenn, what I think? I think that other people who are around me, we seem to be progressively growing together. A lot of my dreams aren't about me at all. Sometimes I'm a man, and sometimes a little boy. Sometimes I'm an old, fat woman with varicose veins, and I'm in places I've never seen, doing things that make no sense.
Well, like they say, you're heading for a new womb to be born out of. And that smoky red light, that's a bad womb. You don't want to go that way. That's a humiliating, low sort of womb. You're probably anticipating your next life, or whatever it is.
He felt foolish, talking like this. Normally he had no theological convictions, but the half-life experience was real, and it had made theologians out of all of them.
Hey, he said, changing the subject. Let me tell you what's happened, what made me come here and bother you. S. Dole Melipone has dropped out of sight.
A moment of silence, and then Ella laughed.
Who or what is an S. Dole Melipone? There can't be any such thing.
The laugh, the unique and familiar warmth of it, made his spine tremble. He remembered that about her, even after so many years. He had not heard Ella's laugh in over a decade.
Maybe you've forgotten, he said.
Ella said,
I haven't forgotten. I wouldn't forget an S. Dole Melipone. Is it like a hobbit?
It's Raymond Hollis's top telepath. We've had at least one inertial sticking close to him ever since G.G. Ashwood first scouted him a year and a half ago. We never lose Melipone. We can't afford to. Melipone can, when necessary, generate twice the psi field of any other Hollis employee. And Melipone is only one of a whole string of Hollis people who've disappeared. Anyhow, disappeared as far as we're concerned. As far as all prudence organizations in the society can make out. So I thought, hell, I'll go ask Ella what's up and what we should do. Like you specified in your will. Remember?
I remember.
But she sounded remote.
Step up your ads on TV. Warn people. Tell them.
Her voice trailed off into silence then.
This bores you,
Runciter said gloomily.
No,
She hesitated, and he felt her once more drift away.
Are they all telepaths?
She asked after an interval.
Telepaths and precogs, mostly. They're nowhere on Earth, I know that. We've got a dozen inactive inertials with nothing to do because the size they've been nullifying aren't around. And what worries me even more, a lot more, is that requests for anti-size have dropped, which you would expect, given the fact that so many size are missing. But I know they're on one single project. I mean, I believe. Anyhow, I'm sure of it. Somebody's hired the bunch of them. But only Hollis knows who it is, or where it is, or what it's all about.
He lapsed into brooding silence then. How would Ella be able to help him figure it out? He asked himself. Stuck here in this casket, frozen out of the world, she knew only what he told her. Yet he had always relied on her sagacity, that particular female form of it. A wisdom not based on knowledge or experience, but on something innate. He had not, during the period she had lived, been able to fathom it. He certainly could not do so now that she lay in chilled immobility. Other women he had known since her death, there had been several, had a little of it, trace amounts, perhaps. Intimations of a greater potentiality, which, in them, never emerged as it had in Ella.
Tell me.
Ella said.
What this Melipone person is like?
A screwball.
Working for money or out of conviction? I always feel wary about that, when they have that psi mystique, that sense of purpose and cosmic identity, like that awful Serapis had. Remember him?
Serapis isn't around anymore. Hollis allegedly bumped him off because he connived to set up his own outfit in competition with Hollis. One of his precogs tipped Hollis off.
He added,
Melipone is much tougher on us than Serapis was. When he's hot, it takes three inertials to balance his field, and there's no profit in that. We collect, or did collect, the same fee we get with one inertial. Because the society has a rate schedule now, which we're bound by.
He liked the society less each year. It had become a chronic obsession with him, its uselessness, its cost, its vainglory.
As near as we can tell, Melipone is a money psi. Does that make you feel better? Is that less bad?
He waited, but heard no response from her.
Ella?
He said. Silence. Nervously, he said,
Hey! Hello there, Ella! Can you hear me? Is something wrong?
Oh, God,
he thought.
She's gone.
A pause. And then, thoughts materialized in his right ear.
My name is Jory.
Not Ella's thoughts. A different Elon, more vital and yet clumsier, without her deft subtlety.
Get off the line,
Runciter said in panic.
I was talking to my wife, Ella. Where'd you come from?
I am Jory,
the thoughts came.
And no one talks to me. I'd like to visit with you a while, mister, if that's okay with you. What's your name?
Stammering, Runciter said,
I want my wife, Mrs. Ella Runciter. I paid to talk to her, and that's who I want to talk to, not you.
I know, Mrs. Runciter.
The thoughts clanged in his ear, much stronger now.
She talks to me, but it isn't the same as somebody like you talking to me. Somebody in the world. Mrs. Runciter is here, where we are. It doesn't count because she doesn't know any more than we do. What year is it, mister? Did they send that big ship to Proxima? I'm very interested in that. Maybe you can tell me. And if you want, I can tell Mrs. Runciter later on, okay?
Runciter popped the plug from his ear, hurriedly set down the earphone and the rest of the gadgetry. He left the stale, dust-saturated office and roamed about among the chilling caskets, row after row, all of them neatly arranged by number. Moratorium employees swam up before him and then vanished as he churned on, searching for the owner.
Is something the matter, Mr. Runciter?
The von Vogelsung person said, observing him as he floundered about.
Can I assist you?
I've got something coming in over the wire,
Runciter panted, halting.
Instead of Ella. Damn you guys and your shoddy business practices, this shouldn't happen. And what does it mean?
He followed after the moratorium owner, who had already started in the direction of Office 2A.
If I ran my business this way...
Did the individual identify himself?
Yeah, he called himself Jory.
Frowning with obvious worry, von Vogelsung said,
That would be Jory Miller. I believe he's located next to your wife, in the bin.
But I can see it's Ella!
After prolonged proximity,
von Vogelsung explained,
There is occasionally a mutual osmosis, a suffusion between the mentalities of half-lifers. Jory Miller's cephalic activity is particularly good. Your wife's is not. That makes for an unfortunately one-way passage of protophasons.
Can you correct it?
Runciter asked hoarsely. He found himself still spent, still panting and shaking.
Get that thing out of my wife's mind and get her back! That's your job!
Von Vogelsung said in a stilted voice.
If this condition persists, your money will be returned to you.
Who cares about the money? Snort the money!
They had reached Office 2A now. Runciter unsteadily reseated himself, his heart laboring so that he could hardly speak.
If you don't get this Jory person off the line,
he half gasped, half snarled,
I'll sue you! I'll close down this place!
Facing the casket, von Vogelsung pressed the audio outlet into his ear and spoke briskly into the microphone.
Phase out, Jory. That's a good boy.
Glancing at Runciter, he said,
Jory passed it 15. That's why he has so much vitality. Actually, this has happened before. Jory has shown up several times where he shouldn't be.
Once more into the microphone, he said,
This is very unfair of you, Jory. Mr. Runciter has come a long way to talk to his wife. Don't dim her signal, Jory. That's not nice.
A pause as he listened to the earphone.
I know her signal is weak.
Again he listened, solemn and frog-like, then removed the earphone and rose to his feet.
What did he say?
Runciter demanded.
Will he get out of there and let me talk to Ella?
Von Vogelsung said,
There's nothing Jory can do. Think of 2 AM radio transmitters, one close by, but limited to only 500 watts of operating power, then another far off, but on the same, or nearly the same frequency, and utilizing 5,000 watts. Hmm? When night comes...
And night, Runciter said, has come.
At least for Ella. And maybe himself as well, if Hollis's missing teeps, parakineticists, precogs, resurrectors, and animators couldn't be found. He had not only lost Ella, he had also lost her advice, Jory having supplanted her before she could give it.
When we return her to the bin, Von Vogelsung was blabbing, we won't install her near Jory again. In fact, if you're agreeable as to paying the somewhat larger monthly fee, we can place her in a high-grade isolated chamber, with walls coated and reinforced with Teflon 26, so as to inhibit heteropsychic infusion from Jory or anybody else.
Isn't it too late?
Runciter said, surfacing momentarily from the depression into which this happening had dropped him.
She may return, once Jory phases out, plus anyone else who may have gotten into her because of her weakened state. She's accessible to almost anyone.
Von Vogelsung chewed his lip, palpably pondering.
She may not like being isolated, Mr. Runciter. We keep the containers, the caskets, as they're called by the lay public, close together for a reason. Wandering through one another's mind gives those in half-life the only—
Put her in solitary right now!
Runciter broke in.
Better she be isolated than not exist at all!
She exists,
Von Vogelsung corrected.
She merely can't contact you. There's a difference.
Runciter said,
A metaphysical difference, which means nothing to me.
I will put her in isolation.
Von Vogelsung said.
But I think you're right. It's too late. Jory has permeated her permanently, to some extent at least. I'm sorry.
Runciter said harshly,
So am I.
3. Instant Ubik has all the fresh flavor of just-brewed drip coffee. Your husband will say, Christ, Sally, I used to think your coffee was only so-so. But now, wow.
Safe,
when taken as directed. Still in gay, pinstripe, clown-style pajamas, Joe Chip hazily seated himself at his kitchen table, lit a cigarette, and after inserting a dime, twiddled the dial of his recently rented pape machine. Having a hangover, he dialed off Interplan News, hovered momentarily at domestic news, and then selected gossip.
Yes, sir,
the pape machine said heartily.
Gossip. Guess what Stanton Mick, the reclusive, interplanetarily known speculator and financier, is up to at this very moment?
Its works whizzed, and a scroll of printed matter crept from its slot. The ejected roll, a document in 4 colors, niftily incised with bold type, rolled across the surface of the neo-teakwood table and bounced to the floor. His head aching, Chip retrieved it, spread it out flat before him. Mick hits World Bank for 2 trill, AP, London. What could Stanton Mick, the reclusive, interplanetarily known speculator and financier, be up to, the business community asked itself, as rumor leaked out of Whitehall that the dashing but peculiar industrial magnate, who once offered to build, free of charge, a fleet by which Israel could colonize and make fertile, otherwise desert areas of Mars, had asked for, and may possibly receive, a staggering and unprecedented loan of...
This isn't gossip,
Joe Chip said to the pape machine.
This is speculation about fiscal transactions. Today I want to read about which TV star is sleeping with whose drug-addicted wife.
He had, as usual, not slept well, at least in terms of REM, rapid eye movement sleep. And he had resisted taking a soporific, because, very unfortunately, his weak supply of stimulants, provided him by the autonomic pharmacy of his CONAP building, had run out, due admittedly to his own oral greed, but nonetheless gone. By law, he could not approach the pharmacy for more until next Tuesday. 2 days away. 2 long days. The pape machine said,
"Set the dial for low gossip."
He did so, and a second scroll, excreted by the pape machine without delay, emerged. He zoomed in on an excellent caricature drawing of Lola Herzberg Wright, licked his lips with satisfaction at the naughty exposure of her entire right ear, then feasted on the text. Accosted by a cutpurse in a fancy New York after-hours mall the other night, Lola Herzberg Wright bounced a swift right jab off the chops of the do-batter, which sent him reeling onto the table, where King Egon Groat of Sweden and an unidentified miss with astonishingly large... The ring construct of his CONAP door jangled. Startled, Joe Chip glanced up, found his cigarette attempting to burn the formica surface of his neo-teakwood table, coped with that, then shuffled blearily to the speak tube mounted handily by the release bolt of the door.
"Who is it?"
he grumbled, checking with his wristwatch. He saw that 8 o'clock had not arrived. Probably the rent robot, he decided, or a creditor. He did not trigger off the release bolt of the door. An enthusiastic male voice from the door's speaker exclaimed,
"I know it's early, Joe, but I just hit town. Gigi Ashwood here. I've got a firm prospect that I snared in Topeka. I read this one is magnificent, and I want your confirmation before I lay the pitch in Runciter's lap. Anyhow, he's in Switzerland."
Chip said, "I don't have my test equipment in the app."
"I'll shoot over to the shop and pick it up for you."
"It's not at the shop."
Reluctantly, he admitted,
"It's in my car. I didn't get around unloading it last night."
In actuality, he had been too pizzled on Papa Pot to get the trunk of his hover car open.
"Can it wait until after 9?
He asked irritably. Gigi Ashwood's unstable, manic energy annoyed him even at noon. This, at 7:40, struck him as downright impossible. Worse even than a creditor.
"Chip, dearie, this is a sweet number. A walking symposium of miracles that'll curl the needles of your gauges. And, in addition, give new life to the firm, which it badly needs. And furthermore..."
"It's an anti-what?" Joe Chip asked. "Telepath?"
"I'll lay it on you right out in front,"
Gigi Ashwood declared.
"I don't know. Listen, Chip."
Ashwood lowered his voice.
"This is confidential, this particular one. I can't stand down here at the gate, gum flapping away out loud. Somebody might overhear. In fact, I'm already picking up the thoughts of some glunk in a ground-level apt. He..."
"Okay,"
Joe Chip said, resigned. Once started, Gigi Ashwood's relentless monologues couldn't be aborted anyhow. He might as well listen to it.
"Give me 5 minutes to get dressed and find out if I've got any coffee left in the app anywhere."
He had a quasi-memory of shopping last night at the CONAP supermarket. In particular, a memory of tearing out a green ration stamp, which could mean either coffee or tea or cigarettes or fancy imported snuff.
"You'll like her,"
Gigi Ashwood stated energetically.
"Although, as often happens, she's the daughter of a..."
"Her?"
In alarm, Joe Chip said,
"My app's unfit to be seen. I'm behind on my payments to the building cleanup robots. They haven't been inside here in 2 weeks.
I'll ask her if she cares."
"Don't ask her. I care. I'll test her out down at the shop, on Runciter's time."
"I read her mind, and she doesn't care."
"How old is she?"
Maybe, he thought, she's only a child. Quite a few new and potential inertials were children, having developed their ability in order to protect themselves against their psionic parents.
"How old are you, dear?"
Gigi Ashwood asked faintly, turning his head away to speak to the person with him.
19,
he reported to Joe Chip. Well, that shot that. But now he had become curious. G.G. Ashwood's razzle-dazzle, wound-up tightness usually manifested itself in conjunction with attractive women. Maybe this girl fell into that category.
"Give me 15 minutes,
he told G.G. If he worked fast and skulked about in a cleanup campaign, and if he missed both coffee and breakfast, he could probably effect a tidy apt by then. At least it seemed worth trying. He rang off, then searched in the cupboards of the kitchen for a broom, manual or self-powered, or vacuum cleaner, helium battery, or wall socket. Neither could be found. Evidently, he'd never been issued any sort of cleaning equipment by the building supply agency. Hell of a time, he thought, to find that out. And he had lived here 4 years. Picking up the vidphone, he dialed 214, the extension for the maintenance circuit of the building.
Listen, he said when the homeostatic entity answered. I'm now in a position to divert some of my funds in the direction of settling my bill vis-a-vis your cleanup robots. I'd like them up here right now to go over my apt. I'll pay the full and entire bill when they're finished.
Sir, you'll pay your full and entire bill before they start.
By now, he had his billfold in hand. From it, he dumped his supply of magic credit keys, most of which by now had been voided. Probably in perpetuity, his relationship with money and the payment of pressing debts being such as it was.
I'll charge my overdue bill against my triangular magic key,
he informed his nebulous antagonist.
That'll transfer the obligation out of your jurisdiction. On your books, it'll show as total restitution.
Plus fines. Plus penalties.
I'll charge those against my heart-shaped...
Mr. Chip, the Ferris and Brockman Retail Credit Auditing and Analysis Agency has published a special flyer on you. Our recept slot received it yesterday, and it remains fresh in our minds. Since July, you've dropped from a triple G status credit-wise to quadruple G. Our department, in fact this entire CONAPT building, is now programmed against an extension of services and or credit to such pathetic anomalies as yourself, sir. Regarding you, everything must hereafter be handled on a basic cash subfloor. In fact, you'll probably be on a basic cash subfloor for the rest of your life. In fact,
he hung up and abandoned the hope of enticing and or threatening the cleanup robots into entering his muddled apt. Instead, he padded into the bedroom to dress. He could do that without assistance. After he had dressed in a sporty maroon wrapper, twinkled toes, turned-up shoes, and a felt cap with a tassel, he poked about hopefully in the kitchen for some manifestation of coffee. None. He then focused on the living room and found, by the door leading to the bathroom, last night's great cape, every spotty blue yard of it, and a plastic bag which contained a half-pound can of authentic Kenya coffee, a great treat and one which only while pizzled would he have risen to, especially in view of his current abominable financial situation. Back in the kitchen, he fished in his various pockets for a dime, and with it started up the coffee pot. Sniffing the, to him, very unusual smell, he again consulted his watch, saw that 15 minutes had passed. He therefore vigorously strode to the apt door, turned the knob, and pulled on the release bolt. The door refused to open. It said,
5 cents, please.
He searched his pockets. No more coins. Nothing.
I'll pay you tomorrow, he told the door.
Again, he tried the knob. Again, it remained locked tight.
What I pay you, he informed it, is in the nature of a gratuity. I don't have to pay you.
I think otherwise, the door said. Look in the purchase contract you signed when you bought this CONAPT.
In his desk drawer, he found the contract. Since signing it, he had found it necessary to refer to the document many times. Sure enough, payment to his door for opening and shutting constituted a mandatory fee, not a tip.
You discover I'm right, the door said. It sounded smug.
From the drawer beside the sink, Joe Chip got a stainless steel knife. With it, he began systematically to unscrew the bolt assembly of his apt's money-gulping door.
I'll sue you,
the door said as the first screw fell out. Joe Chip said,
I've never been sued by a door, but I guess I can live through it.
A knock sounded on the door.
Hey, Joe, baby, it's me, Gigi Ashwood! And I've got her right here with me! Open up!
Put a nickel in the slot for me, Joe said. Mechanism seems to be jammed on my side.
A coin rattled down into the works of the door. It swung open, and there stood Gigi Ashwood, with a brilliant look on his face. It pulsed with sly intensity, an erratic, gleaming triumph, as he propelled the girl forward and into the apt. She stood for a moment, staring at Joe, obviously no more than 17, slim and copper-skinned, with large, dark eyes.
My God, he thought. She's beautiful.
She wore an ersatz canvas work shirt and jeans, heavy boots caked with what appeared to be authentic mud. Her tangle of shiny hair was tied back and knotted with a red bandana. A rolled-up sleeve showed tanned, competent arms. At her imitation leather belt, she carried a knife, a field telephone unit, and an emergency pack of rations and water. On her bare, dark forearm, he made out a tattoo. Caveat emptor. It read. He wondered what that meant.
This is Pat,
Gigi Ashwood said, his arm with ostentatious familiarity around the girl's waist.
Never mind her last name.
Square and puffy, like an overweight brick, wearing his usual mohair poncho, apricot-colored felt hat, argyle ski socks, and carpet slippers, he advanced toward Joe Chip. Self-satisfaction smirking from every molecule in his body. He had found something of value here, and he meant to make the most of it.
Pat, this is the company's highly skilled first-line electrical type tester.
Coolly, the girl said to Joe Chip,
Is it you that's electrical, or your tests?
We trade off, Joe said.
He felt, from all around him, the miasma of his uncleaned-up apt. It radiated the specter of debris and clutter, and he knew that Pat had already noticed.
Sit down, he said awkwardly. Have a cup of actual coffee.
Such luxury,
Pat said, seating herself at the kitchen table. Reflexively, she gathered the week's heap of papes into a neater pile.
How can you afford real coffee, Mr. Chip?
Gigi Ashwood said,
Joe gets paid a hell of a lot. The firm couldn't operate without him.
Reaching out, he took a cigarette from the package lying on the table.
Put it back, Joe Chip said. I'm almost out, and I used up my last green ration stamp on the coffee.
I paid for the door,
Gigi pointed out. He offered the pack to the girl.
Joe puts on an act. Pay no attention. Like, look how he keeps his place. Shows he's creative. All geniuses live like this. Where's your test equipment, Joe? We're wasting time.
To the girl, Joe said, You're dressed oddly.
I maintain the subsurface vidphone lines at the Topeka kibbutz,
Pat said.
Only women can hold jobs involving manual labor at that particular kibbutz. That's why I applied there, instead of the Wichita Falls kibbutz.
Her black eyes blazed pridefully. Joe said,
That inscription on your arm, that tattoo... Is that Hebrew?
Latin.
Her eyes veiled her amusement.
I've never seen an app so cluttered with rubbish. Don't you have a mistress?
These electrical expert types have no time for tarradiddle,
Gigi Ashwood said irritably.
Listen, Chip, this girl's parents work for Ray Hollis. If they knew she was here, they'd give her a frontal lobotomy.
To the girl, Joe Chip said,
They don't know you have a counter talent?
No.
She shook her head.
I didn't really understand it either until your scout sat down with me in the kibbutz cafeteria and told me. Maybe it's true.
She shrugged.
Maybe not. He said you could show me objective proof of it with your testing battery.
How would you feel, he asked her, if the tests show that you have it?
Reflecting, Pat said,
It seems so negative. I don't do anything. I don't move objects or turn stones into bread or give birth without impregnation, or reverse the illness process in sick people, or read minds, or look into the future. Not even common talents like that. I just negate somebody else's ability,
It seems...
she gestured.
Stultifying.
As a survival factor for the human race, Joe said, it's as useful as the psi talents, especially for us norms. The anti-psi factor is a natural restoration of ecological balance. One insect learns to fly, so another learns to build a web to trap him. Is that the same as no flight? Clams developed hard shells to protect them. Therefore, birds learn to fly the clam up high in the air and drop him on a rock. In a sense, you're a life form preying on the size, and the size are life forms that prey on the norms. That makes you a friend of the norm class. Balance, a full circle, predator and prey. It appears to be an eternal system, and frankly, I can't see how it could be improved.
I might be considered a traitor,
Pat said. Does it bother you?
It bothers me that people will feel hostile toward me. But I guess you can't live very long without arousing hostility. You can't please everybody, because people want different things. Please one, and you displease another.
Joe said, what is your anti-talent?
It's hard to explain.
Like I say, G.G. Ashwood said, it's unique. I never heard of it before.
Which psi talent does it counteract? Joe asked the girl.
Precog?
Pat said.
I guess.
She indicated G.G. Ashwood, whose smirk of enthusiasm had not dimmed.
Your scout, Mr. Ashwood, explained it to me. I knew I did something funny. I've always had these strange periods in my life, starting my 6th year. I never told my parents because I sensed that it would displease them.
Are they precogs? Joe asked.
Yes.
You're right. It would have displeased them. But if you used it around them, even once, they would have known. Didn't they suspect? Didn't you interfere with their ability? Pat said. She gestured.
I think I did interfere, but they didn't know it.
Her face showed bewilderment. Let me explain, Joe said, how the anti-precog generally functions. Functions, in fact, in every case we know of. The precog sees a variety of futures, laid out side by side like cells in a beehive. For him, one has greater luminosity, and this he picks. Once he's picked it, the anti-precog can do nothing. The anti-precog has to be present when the precog is in the process of deciding, not after. The anti-precog makes all futures seem equally real to the precog. He aborts his talent to choose at all. A precog is instantly aware when an anti-precog is nearby, because his entire relation to the future is altered. In the case of telepaths, a similar impairment...
She goes back in time,
G.G. Ashwood said. Joe stared at him.
Back in time,
G.G. repeated, savoring this. His eyes shot shafts of significance to every part of Joe Chip's kitchen.
The precog affected by her still sees one predominant future. Like you said, the one luminous possibility. And he chooses it, and he's right. But why is it right? Why is it luminous? Because this girl,
he shrugged in her direction,
Pat, controls the future. That one luminous possibility is luminous because she's gone into the past and changed it. By changing it, she changes the present, which includes the precog. He's affected without knowing it, and his talent seems to work. Whereas... it really doesn't. So that's one advantage of her anti-talent over other anti-precog talents. The other, and greater, is that she can cancel out the precog's decision after he's made it. She can enter the situation later on, and this problem has always hung us up, as you know. If we didn't get in there from the start, we couldn't do anything. In a way, we never could truly abort the precog ability as we've done with the others, right? Hasn't that been a weak link in our services?
He eyed Joe Chip expectantly.
Interesting,
Joe said presently.
Hell, interesting!
G.G. Ashwood thrashed about indignantly.
This is the greatest anti-talent to emerge thus far!
In a low voice, Pat said,
I don't go back in time.
She raised her eyes, confronted Joe Chip half apologetically, half belligerently.
I do something, but Mr. Ashwood has built it up all out of proportion to reality.
I can read your mind,
Gigi said to her, looking a little nettled.
I know you can change the past. You've done it.
Pat said,
I can change the past, but I don't go into the past. I don't time travel, as you want your tester to think.